next talk, we have Patrick, who will tell us about Côté.
Yes, Côté, yes.
Côté.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so...
So will tell us about what will you
say? Next slide.
Okay.
Wide Field Astrophysics Initiatives in Canada.
Is that like all the sky that we know?
No, this is a project. So I thought I'd start off with a science slide, sort of motivate this. It's much better back here.
It looks great.
Yeah, so back here, it's breathtaking. Here, you can't see very much.
Turn our chairs around.
Yes.
Yeah, we can do that.
So what this is the Canada-France Hawaii Telescope on top of Mauna Kea in Chile. And this is a footprint of 100 square degrees that was imaged by this telescope, CFHT, by my collaborators and I. This is pointing at the Virgo cluster, which is the nearest large collection of galaxies in the local universe. And so this was a six-year project to image to extraordinary depth in many different bands in the optical, with the goal of trying to understand where the galaxies were in this volume locally. And if you go to this slide, and again, you can't really see it, but back here, trust me, it's beautiful. So what you're seeing there in the background, this is...
Down in front.
This is a... So this is an image of...
Can we walk it? Yeah, that's smart. Oh my God, the people will see that.
Experimental
CTGA.
Yeah. So this is this area, 100 square degrees.
That's good. We can see it.
No, but now the light from the moving
it forward.
Go moving it to the light. That's crazy.
No, that way. Even through the window.
That's so much worse.
Oh boy.
We're gonna blame me now.
Let's just get it.
No.
How many experimentals does it take to move a team?
Who's chairing the faculty? The theory team, which
I know, you're the one responsible.
Well, now you're making this silly. It's crazy talk.
So maybe if we come this way?
I learned from McCarthy.
Great.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so is that any better? So this is a map of the galaxies in the Virgo cluster. Each one of these little elliptical blobs of light that you're seeing here, that's a model of a galaxy built by fitting the actual isophotes of the galaxies in these images. This is an image that was created very recently by my graduate student, who's going to be defending her thesis in this summer. But the advantage here is everything that you're seeing is a member of the Virgo cluster. The previous image you could see was very messy because there were bright foreground stars and there was a multitude of faint background galaxies. You had to separate this sort of is a needle in the haystack problem. There are 4,000 galaxies or halos here, but there were 40 million sources detected in the optical imaging. So you had to sort through all of the foreground and the background to find these galaxies. And I'm showing here, these are zoomed in images. These are the actual CFHT images going progressively deeper. And then finally, a zoom in on a little pile of stars here, which is from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is the equivalent in the Virgo cluster at 17 megaparsecs. This is the same of the kind of things that we're finding in the halo of the Milky Way galaxy, which are thought to be very, very heavily dominated by dark matter. So I chose this picture because it combines the wide field with the depth and the high resolution from Hubble in this small area. And ultimately, what we'd like to do to understand dark matter on small scales is to measure radial velocities for those stars and get the mass of the dark matter halo. So this is my way of sort of motivating this talk, which is basically to tell you a little bit about two projects that are underway in Canada in wide field astronomy. And these are strategic projects, Canadian-led, that fall within the community's plans for the next sort of 10 years. So the outline of the talk here, use the hockey stick, you can see it. I'll talk about our community's efforts for planning, which is this long-range plan. I'll tell a little bit about what's going on internationally in wide-field astronomy. And then I'll talk about two projects primarily, in fact, entirely. One is a space-based telescope, something called Castor. This would be a Canadian led project. And then I'll start off with another project, which is something called the Mauna Kea Spectroscopic Explorer. This is a ground-based telescope, and in fact, this is a telescope, a proposal to replace the CFHT, the same telescope that took those images. Okay, so a bit about the long-range plan. This is a slide I prepared. I was giving a talk at the Royal BC Museum, a public talk, last week. And I wanted to just explain to people that if you were an astronomer working in Canada 50 years ago, what telescopes did you have at your disposal to do your research? And so you recognize some of these venerable telescopes here. Here's one in DREO. This was a radio telescope that used to be in Algonquin Park. This is the 72-inch telescope in Victoria, where Seb and I come from. This is just down the road here in Richmond Hill. So some of these telescopes are still operational. Some have been shut down, but 50 years later, the Canadian community has a different set of telescopes at its disposal. CFHT is one of them. We have twin 8-meter telescopes, one in Hawaii, one in Chile, and then we have ALMA, which is a millimeter, submillimeter telescope in the Atacama. So over that 50-year period, to go from the top telescopes to the bottom telescopes requires some planning. It may not feel like that all the time, but it's actually a very methodical decision. And so we have to plan for the future. Okay, so there's this long-range plan. It's a community exercise, happens once per decade. We're just getting ready for our third of these. The US community sort of set the standard here. They've been doing these since the 60s, I believe. So what we do is once every 10 years, we get together as a community, we write white papers trying to identify the highest priorities in science, in astronomy. We argue the case for different facilities that we should build or join, et cetera. We discuss this in town halls. A panel is formed. They take all this advice and they make recommendations. Once per decade, and at the midpoint of each decade, there's a review because things change rapidly. So this is the plan from 2010. You can find it online. Out here in Victoria, this is the DAO site, the optical site of NRC Hertzberg. And as Michael pointed out this morning, NRC, by parliamentary mandate, is responsible for operating and administering astronomical telescopes. And in fact, it's not just ground-based. It says nothing about ground versus space, but in fact, we're in the practice of supporting ground-based telescopes. The long-range plans makes recommendations for both ground and space-based. So as we look we're coming up towards the next decadal plan, or the long-range plan, we have to prepare for what's coming in the next decade. And so I just wanted to mention three major facilities out of the numerous ones, but three particularly important facilities that are going to happen internationally. The first I wanted to mention is this, the LSST project, of course, down in Chile. This is led by the NSF and the Department of Energy. As I'm sure many people know, this is a wide field 8-meter class telescope that's going to survey the sky every few days, the southern sky, so an area of at least 20,000 square degrees, and it's going to do this for a minimum lifetime of 10 years. And so it's motivated for a number of reasons, including dark energy and cosmology, et cetera, but also to identify asteroids, for instance, potential threats to the Earth. So that is going to happen. Over in Europe, the ESA is producing its dark energy flagship mission. It's an M-class mission, so a major investment. This is the 1.2-meter infrared and red optical telescope, which is going to be doing wide-field imaging. And by wide-field, I mean about a third of the sky, 15,000 square degrees, which is going to be doing all kinds of interesting science, lots of legacy science, but it's motivated mainly for dark energy. And it's going to do this primarily through weak lensing measurements. And then finally, for space telescopes, we have WFIRST, which is the NASA mission. This is scheduled later than the other two. The other two were 2021 or so. WFIRST will come along probably 2025 or 26. This is a larger telescope. This is the same mirror size as Hubble, of course. it's going to do, it's a combination of surveys and guest observer time, but the primary cosmological survey is this, an area a tenth the size of Euclid, but to much greater depth.
Do I read that right? They're designing this to be serviceable at L2?
Where do you see that?
Serviceable spacecraft module.
Yeah, that's the first I don't believe it's going to be serviced. Maybe there's a capacity for this, so they may want to do it, but as far as I know, there's no plans that it's going to be serviced.
I don't think that means serviceable by astronauts.
Not by astronauts, but it could robotically, it could be serviced.
But that's like a massively different.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a legacy of where they got the satellite from, which is the not the L2.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's a legacy from where they got the diagram from.
Okay, so.
Is there a time scale for W1st?
Oh, yes. So 2025, 2026, thereabouts. So.
That's in available for use.
Yes, that's right. So W1st, as probably you would have noticed, that it was actually zeroed out in the president's budget in the U.S., I think in February. But it was reinstated in the budget by Congress 2 months later. So it's still a go, and it's still sort of mid-2020s. Okay, so those are the main imaging facilities that are going to dominate the landscape in the next decade. Of course, there's many other facilities. We've heard a lot about these during this workshop here. Radio, submillimeter, far infrared. We have the ground-based large optical telescopes, et cetera. Gaia, which is an important astrometric satellite that's producing results now. And so if you take a view of this, this portfolio, what are the things that are missing, the two most critical things? Arguably, you could make the case that it's a telescope on the ground with a large collecting area dedicated to spectroscopy. So if you think of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, for instance, which was a tremendous success from a scientific point of view, that was a combination of wide-field imaging and spectroscopy. That was that sort of leveraging of the two data sets was where most of the power was. And so this is the motivation strategically for the MSE project. And then in terms of imaging capabilities, you'll see that W1st and Euclid are space-based observatories but operating in the infrared or red optical. LSST covers the optical, not the infrared, but it does it at ground-based resolution. And so at the moment, if you wanted short wavelength, so blue optical or UV imaging at high spatial resolution, that's Hubble. And Hubble won't be around forever. Hubble also has a very hugely successful instrument, but it's limited in the sense that it has a small field of view. It's now quite old. And at some point, very likely by the middle of the next decade, either the batteries or the gyros will fail. And that will be the end of Hubble. And the community internationally has come to rely on Hubble, and I think it will be missed when it's gone. Okay, so back to the long-range plan. If you open that document and you look under recommendations, there's a handy table here. And you can see there's separated into ground and space. On the ground, you can see the projects, the recommendations go from the very large down to the small. VLOT is the Very Large Optical Telescope, which we now know as TMT. Michael gave a nice talk on CHIME earlier today. Down here at the bottom, you can see there was something called the NGCFHT, that's Next Generation CFHT. So just as LRP 2010 was going to press, a number of us in the university community working also with Hertzberg suggested maybe we should investigate the possibility of taking CFHT and converting it into a spectroscopic telescope. And so that was intriguing enough to the LRP panel that they said, you should investigate it. The science case looks to be very strong, but is this feasible? Can you do this, et cetera? But they recommended that it be studied, so investment on the small level. And it was revisited in the middle of the decade. In space, there are a number of recommendations all the way from balloons and microsats up to large. And the recommendations here was that Canada should join either Euclid or W1st at a significant level, or lead its own satellite, a Canadian space telescope, that would complement these dark energy, wide field imaging missions. And so if you can't really read this, but they basically made that recommendation, and they noted that such a project would break new ground for Canadian space astronomy, would allow these companies to showcase their technologies, and noted that Canada should be at the point where we can lead such a mission of this scope, you know, once per decade, let's say. Okay, so that's, yeah?
Question about that. So you said you had a suggestion, and then what's the process by which you got feedback? Take a deeper look at that possibility? I mean, is it something that happened intrinsically within the NRC, or was something that the government said?
The MSE project, for instance?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we made the... So what the mechanics of it was that we wrote a white paper saying this was something that we should do. We advocated that at town hall meetings, had support from the community. The long-range plan panel who wrote the report said, it sounds interesting, you need to investigate it. And this is where we come back to what Michael was saying. The advantage of NRC is we have some capacity for long-term planning. And so a small amount of money was devoted to this for a two-year study to look at the science and the technology. Was this feasible?
Devoted by
NRC. Yes.
The LRP panel is not NRC, that's sort of astronomy, Canada-wide astronomy, you know, academic mostly.
Yeah.
Right, because I'm more familiar with the CATO. The CATO makes a recommendation, but they have no power to tell you, go investigate this more.
So. That's right. And so that comes down to the granting agencies. So to make any of these things happen, it comes down to the granting agencies. In this case, the recommendation wasn't to build MSE, it was to investigate it, to see, is this feasible? Are there interested parties? Because as we'll come to, that's a project that Canada would definitely not do alone. So we need some partners. And so part of it was to engage the international community to look into this. Okay, so let's look at each of these projects in turn. Is that clock right? Okay. All right, so this is the basic concept. I've sort of covered some of this already. Here's CFHT on the summit of Mauna Kea, 4,200 meters. I've said arguably the world's premier astronomical site. It's in the northern hemisphere. It is absolutely the world's premier astronomical site from a number of considerations. The seeing is excellent. It's a dry site, low water vapor, large number of usable nights, although not this year, as it turns out. Mauna Kea has had very bad weather. But as one thing we've learned from the TMT exercise, when we've been looking for possible alternate sites, in the northern hemisphere, you can't come close to Mauna Kea. And in fact, on Mauna Kea, if you look, there's a reason why all these telescopes are built here. You see it better over here. So there's a number of international facilities built on Mauna Kea. This is CFHT here at the end of the summit ridge. So among all of these sites, this is arguably the best site.
Sorry, is it still there? Is it Mauna Kea where the volcano is?
No.
No,
that was... Oh, it's the same island. It's the same island.
Oh, it's the same island.
Same island. Yeah, one volcano down. That's Mauna Kea.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But as, since you've mentioned it, in fact, I think at the last couple of nights, these telescopes, Keck, have been offline because of the earthquake.
I was put on tarp.
So when I visited this a couple of years ago, we drove through large lava flow regions, which, okay, that's presumably from Mauna Loa.
Southern part of Mauna Loa.
Yeah. So is that going to create infrastructure headaches for the...
No, I don't think so. I mean, apart from the occasional earthquake. But,
of course.
And there's no chance that that all of the excess heat causes seeing problems or anything?
No, I don't think so.
Far away.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the proposed site for TMT is over here, incidentally.
Unless you're one of us.
So is that off the peak, then, where you were just pointing?
Yes. It's a site called 13 North, so it's just off the peak. You need a lot of real estate to host TMT. Yeah, but CFHT is one of, so Mauna Kea is, there's something called the master plan for Mauna Kea. There's no ability to just develop it indefinitely nor a desire to, so there has to be some sort of maintenance ecologically and culturally. You have to be aware of what you're doing up there. CFHT is one of the telescopes that has been traditionally identified as a site for possible redevelopment. And the whole idea from the underlying this MSE concept was, we'll take this telescope. CFHT went into operation in 1979, so it's now an older telescope. Can we repurpose the telescope? In other words, you reuse the pier, the bottom part of the telescope, to support a larger telescope, which we said would be a 10-meter class facility, so more collecting area, greater sensitivity, with a wide-field spectroscopic capability. So this is a strategic reinvestment and leveraging of Canada's investment in the staff, the telescope structure, and importantly, the site. And so the hope was that by the middle of the next decade, we could have done this and have sort of expanded CFHT. So it wasn't just a Canada, France, Hawaii partnership, but it was a sort of broader international effort. This is an actual engineering model, a rendition of what it would appear like on the site. So it's very important not to change the overall three-dimensional footprint here.
How is that possible? Is it just because the dome for CFHT was built much larger than it really needed to be?
Yes. Not just the dome, the telescope itself. And so if you ask the weight of CFHT, which was sort of the last of the 4-meter, that generation of telescopes, is about 270 tons. A modern 10-meter class telescope is about 270 tons. So what we would do is then we reuse there's four floors to the existing telescope, and then the enclosure with the telescope. We'd remove the enclosure and the telescope, one floor, and reinforce it. We've done some seismic tests to see that, in fact, it can support this. And then rebuild a larger telescope with a new dome.
Why is it important that the three-dimensional...
Culturally,
change?
It's a cultural issue that we don't want to disturb the site or to make it look any more developed than it already is.
So it's not because it would occlude other people's view.
No. Okay, so there's a long history here. I'm going to skip over this quickly. So going back to the original notion, and it was just a notion in 2010, we did a lot of work on science and technical feasibility studies. We formed international science teams, I think at the time had 60 or so members from different countries. The science case was overwhelming. I mean, it was very clear that this is a very important facility. There was interest in it. Technically, it looked feasible. But to make further progress, you have to come up with a full design and a budget and a schedule, et cetera. And so they officially came up with a project office dedicated to doing this. This was the CFHT board made this recommendation. Project office was formed with dedicated people. We changed the name. Because if you're trying to encourage people to join the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, you want a new name. And so that's when the official partnership started. We produced the detailed science case beginning in 2015. We had the conceptual design for a number of, I think, 10 different subsystems last year. And now the project has officially made the transition to the preliminary design phase. So we're just waiting for the last of the funding from the partners to fall into place. We have a number of partners lined up. It's very likely that the U.S. will be added to this list, at least for the preliminary design phase. So that's very important.
Yeah, do they have a competing project?
They know
you need wide field spectroscopy.
Yes, it's not lost on them. They're very aware of it. And they're getting ready for their decadal planning process. They've examining all the options of building their own telescope, retrofitting existing telescopes, joining international efforts. There's a suggestion like this from the Europeans. But MSE, because we started so quickly, is in the lead position.
So there isn't
nothing at the same stage.
And is Keck also coming to the end of life, needing a refurbishment, or it's
no.
a lot newer?
It's a lot newer. So the first light there was 1993.
Subaru a little bit, PFS, I guess.
And there's Subaru, so there's another Japanese telescope there, Subaru. They have an instrument somewhat like this, but not as powerful. Okay, so the science team then went out and they made a number of detailed science cases shown in this illegible table. So you can see resolved sources, extragalactic sources. This is separated because of technically, one requires low spectral resolution, one high. different fibers, etc. But you can see this, the science cases go all the way from peculiar velocities to reverberation mapping down to the studying the planets, the hosts of exoplanets, etc. And then there are all these requirements, like to do the actual science, you need a certain spectral resolution, you need to rotate the, have a certain focal plane, you need certain sensitivity, how do you need to calibrate the data, how do you want to operate the telescope?
What are these? Well, some are green, bright green, the others?
I think this is to highlight, this was not made by me, this is by Alan McConaughey, but I think this is to highlight the key, the ones that drive this.
The most important.
Yes. And so, then you can sort of distill that down to something like this. I've tried to sort of capture this here. The key point is the science requirements drive the design. So for a facility like this, for people who are interested, say, in nearby stars, they want to observe, they have a certain wavelength region that they would like to observe. People who are looking at the high redshift universe are trying to look for certain features, redshifted up to redshifts of whatever. And so that drives you to a certain kind of design. And this is true of all of these science requirements. So you want wide coverage in terms of wavelength, chemical tagging, and you want to understand abundances. Well, that means you have to have high spectral resolution. Other science cases require low or medium science spectral resolution.
R is the inverse of the energy resolution?
R is the resolving power, basically. So it's lambda over delta lambda.
Okay,
so then certain cases you want to measure velocities of, like the little dwarf galaxy I showed at the second slide. You want to have a certain precision in those measurements to look at the lowest mass dark matter halos. That tells you you need a certain velocity precision, and so on and so on. So this tells you what kind of design you require. Now, this is the engineering model. This is the current design of the telescope, this at the time of conceptual design. So we could spend a lot of time going through this. Again, this is better over here, but...
You cannot read the fine print.
Can't read. Okay. But this is a full detailed engineering model. So you can see, here's the pier of CFHT. It gets reinforced at the bottom. One of the floors comes off, and then you have a new enclosure. The enclosure is a Collot-style design, which is the same kind of design used on many large telescopes, including TMT. You have an upper end system here, which consists of a wide field corrector and atmospheric dispersion corrector. So basically to provide sharp images over a full field, which is 1.5 square degrees. So that's quite wide, very wide, as a matter of fact, for the telescope of this size. You have a fiber positioning system, so it moves the fibers at the focal plane, 4,300 fibers, all of which pick off the light of an individual source. And then it's fed by a fiber transmission system down to two spectrographs, a low resolution sitting here, kind of like a Naismith platform, but we don't really have a Naismith platform. But this is where the low and medium resolution spectrographs are. And the high resolution fibers come down, and they feed this high resolution spectrograph located down below, which gives resolutions up to 40,000. There's a segmented mirror here, 60 segmented mirrors, hexagonal, the same as TMT, that gives a total aperture of 11.25 meters. So aside from the sort of 30 meter class, the three big 30 meter class telescopes, this is the largest optical telescope currently being planned. All right. Okay, and just a bit of Canadian content, because at NRC we're always keen on working with industry, supporting Canadian industry. It's very important for us. Just chose a couple of examples. I mentioned the Collot design. This is design based on the company out of Port Coquitlam, Empire Dynamic Structures, the same one who are designing the dome for TMT. Has this very interesting design where you have an aperture here and it rotates in two different directions so you can point anywhere. And this is a very good design for a number of reasons. It's low mass, uses low power, is buffeted again, and it's very resilient to wind, which can cause seeing problems or shutter or shake the dome. Obviously, the fibers, we have a lot of fibers. This is critical for a number of reasons. You want the fibers that are very robust and they have high transmission, et cetera. So In Victoria, Hertzberg, where we're partnering with FiberTech Optica, which is just down the road here. That's a partnership that first started with CFHT and Gemini. This is Gemini here, Canadian. We are a partner in Gemini, of course. And this is a fiber, 270-meter fiber, which runs from Gemini into the Coudet room at the bottom of the current CFHT and uses its high-resolution spectrograph. So this was basically a spectacular demonstration of how to get the most out of two telescopes working together. We got Gemini essentially got a high-resolution spectrograph for free because Hertzberg and FiberTech were able to figure out how to get good transmission across this fiber.
Is that purely passive? I mean, you can't amplify this, right?
Yeah, no, it's passive. Yeah. It was very impressive. And I think many people were skeptical at the outset of the project whether it could be done. And over a certain wavelength range, the high-resolution spectrograph, this spectrograph, which is fiber-fed 270 meters, outperforms its competitors on Keck and Subaru. So it's a great demonstration. So I'm way behind schedule. So I'll just go quickly over a couple. I wanted to squeeze in a few science cases. So I chose these on just to give you a flavor of the breadth of science. So people who are interested in the synthesis of the elements like to look at the oldest, most metal-deficient stars in the galaxy. So this was the old stars that were the most chemically pristine, ages of 12 billion, 13 billion years, presumably. And you wanted to look at the pattern of chemical enrichment at that very early time in the collapsing galaxy. And so with MSC, you'd be able to observe millions of such remote halo stars. You would do it at medium spectral resolution. This is one here. This is giving you the full wavelength coverage from 3,700 angstroms all the way up to 9,000 angstroms. And you can see a wealth of lines here, which are quite interesting for understanding the stars themselves. And then in three windows, in the UV, green, and red, you would have very high resolution capabilities as well. So you can imagine here in the UV, which is rich in lines, you can zoom in and you can identify all these different chemical species that tell you about R process, S process, et cetera. And so this would be the ultimate follow-up to the Gaia mission, for instance. You could do in situ studies of the chemical abundances of stars. So you can't see this either, but over here you can see there's, in 2000, we knew of something like 9 dwarf satellites of the Milky Way. After Sloan, PanSTARRS, the Dark Energy Survey, I think this number is up to several dozen, depending on what you call a globular cluster, a star cluster, or a dwarf galaxy. But the predictions are that in the era of LSST, if the CDM models are correct, and depending on how the baryons cool in the dark matter halos, there could be hundreds or perhaps even thousands of such low-mass galaxies. And they're very interesting for understanding the distribution of dark matter on small scales. The problem is that there's other things at play in these galaxies. So is it dark matter that you're measuring? Some people have argued that the gravity does strange things in these regimes. It's also possible that these things are being unbound. You just happen to see them, basically tides are pulling them apart. And then there could be other things. Some of them as mundane as they could have these objects, which have velocity dispersions of a few kilometers per second maximum. Maybe it's just binary stars. You see the orbital motion of the constituent binaries and you're fooled into thinking that there's a lot of dark matter there. But in fact, there is none. And so to do that, if you put all this together, what you need are very large samples, and you need wide radial coverage and high velocity precision.
So this is by mapping the visible matter, basically.
Yes, using the stars as dynamical test particles, and then doing something like a Jeans equation.
I see. What is the expected lower halo mass you would be sensitive to?
Well, it's a good question. Typically, if you believe the current measurements, you're actually probing dark matter halo masses down to a few, several times 10 to the 6,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Perhaps you could do better. I mean, you're limited by the fact that your radial velocity precision currently is on the order of 2 kilometers per second. And one of those science cases here was we wanted to get down well below 1 meter per second. The goal was 100 meters per second, which is challenging. Well, that's the question. That is actually the key question. You would like to know, are there dark halos there?
Yeah, why?
Yeah, there's still other clusters.
Just because the potential well is so shallow that
you don't concentrate the gas.
But,
I mean, the baryons evaporate, I mean, baryons cool, the density is similar. I mean, you have the density that was the ambient density of collapse. I'm confused about the statement.
I think there's some typical gene scale on the gas, and you want that to be small enough that collapses into the halo. If the gas was completely cold,
but I would say I would argue that you want to do the opposite thing. You take your imaging telescopes, you find the objects, and then you measure. You see, can you find them?
Right.
If you do find them, then you need to follow them up.
Yeah. Is there a way to do cross-check with lensing data?
Lensing? No.
Is it just too sparse?
You can do there's some of these. There's neutral molecular gas that you can also use as a cross-check. That suffers from different problems to the stars.
Yes.
And
that's a good thing in some ways.
Yes.
Okay.
And so this is just a demonstration with such a facility, you could plan very ambitious redshift surveys. So you could, so our colleagues in Australia were quite interested in this. They have a long history of redshift surveys. And they basically showed that with a 7-year survey scheduled cleverly, you could build up a survey of galaxies spanning, look back times up to 11 or more gigayears. And so you would be able to do the equivalent of Sloan surveys in 7 or possibly 8 slices, all the way up to the era of peak star formation in the universe. And so, a project like this would be unthinkable unless you had a dedicated facility with the aperture and the multiplexing. So hopefully this comes to pass. We're hoping that it gets a strong recommendation in the next LRP. As I said, we're moving into the preliminary design phase. We have, I think Alan has told me that there's basically half of the money needed for the next phase, which is about on the order of $25 million, is already pledged. And so hopefully this is going to get sorted out in the next year or so, and then we can look forward to seeing this facility in Mauna Kea sometime in the 2020s.
Is the LRP going to be delayed if the US version is delayed?
I don't know the answer to that. I do know that it's being discussed a delay in the decadal plan, but there's a lot of people are hesitant to actually do that. Okay, so now I'm going to switch gears totally and move to space. And so you recall that there was a second project. This was this Canadian Space Telescope. We've given it the name the Cosmological Advanced Survey Telescope for Optical and UV Research, which is a bit of a mouthful. But remember, it's a Canadian Space Telescope, so we wanted some Canadian content in there. Okay, and again, I'm sort of behind schedule here. I won't go into the history. It's a long, protracted history. I can trace the idea right back to a meeting at CSA headquarters in 2006. Perhaps some of you were there, where there were 100 astronomers summoned to CSA headquarters to do a planning exercise. It was a 2-day event. And one of the things that came out of that was a possible wide-field imaging telescope, basically to support various dark energy surveys, and also with a mind to the eventual demise of Hubble. So I won't go through all this in detail, just suffice it to say that there's been a number of studies, including a major one in 2011 and 12, which was the original concept study. That was well received, but there were obviously some technical issues that needed further investigation. And so since then, CSA on a shoestring budget has sort of kept a number of studies going on the different technologies and trying to reduce risk, retire risk associated with the project. In the 2015-2016 midterm review, it was well received, this project, and the midterm review said, okay, we've seen enough. The CSA must go to a phase 0 study in the next 12 months Phase zero in the Canadian Space Agency parlance is the last thing you do before there's a decision made, yay or nay, on a telescope, on a project. So this sort of brings us to earlier this year. We've started a new study, which is, it's not called a phase zero for various political reasons, but its effect, combined with the previous technical work, this is a study to continue the technical work and update the science case. And so we're hoping that this will essentially be the equivalent of a phase zero study. And the Canadian government and the space agency can make a decision very soon next year. This is the actual details of the study. I've gone through this, basically update the science case, come up with a final design for the telescope, understand the risk, cost, and schedule, which is important for recruiting partners. This is Canadian-led, but not Canadian-only. It's basically the official kickoff date was the last day of January. It's supposed to wrap up around this time next year, March 2019. It's a partnership between industry. Our three main industrial partners are Honeywell, ABB, and Magellan. So these are important players in aerospace in Canada. On the government side, we have Hertzberg and the CSA, and then a network of universities, scientists at universities, including Waterloo, I'll note. And then we have some potential international partners lined up as well. JPL is potentially interested here. They're contributing so far. And the Indians, our colleagues in India, are potentially interested as well. So we've just expanded the science team from those original, we had a science team of about a dozen people. That's not enough capacity to really get the best, strongest possible science case. So there's an open call. So people here, anyone, people at the Perimeter Institute, if you're willing to contribute to helping develop the science case, you would be absolutely welcome. I've noted some of the people in the room who are participating, and I will also point out that Will Percival and Michael Ballow are involved in this project as well.
What does red mean?
Red is their. Oops.
Don't ask.
So yeah, I should have said. These are the science working groups, and they run from all for cosmology, time domain, galaxies, AGN, near field cosmology, stellar astrophysics, exoplanets, and solar system. We wanted it as broad as possible science case, because if Canada is going to do a project like this, it's clear that everybody in the country must benefit. And
the red are the chairs.
The red are the chairs of the individual science working groups. Okay, so here's the mission. In a nutshell, basically, I meant to disable that. Okay, ignore this if it's not humanly possible, but come back to it in a moment. The telescope is it's called a three-mirror anastigmat design. It's a design that's used in, for instance, Euclid uses the same design. It gives a wide field of view with a sharp image quality. It would be made out of hyper-polished silicon carbide, very strong. Can be polished very, very accurately. Gaia, for instance, was built with this, and Euclid as well, as a matter of fact. So the focal plane, it's a huge focal plane divided into three channels. It does three imaging and three filters. So in something of like a G-band, a U-band, and a broad UV band. The field of view is about a half a degree on a side. So that's about a quarter of the field of the CFHT. But it's doing it at a resolution which is comparable to Hubble. So it separates the imaging into three channels, the three different focal planes. We use CMOS detectors. This is being reevaluated to make the best possible choice. But we image in these three filters simultaneously. This is the actual telescope, the payload inside the bus here. This is about 4 meters high. The whole thing is about 1,300 kilograms, so think of like a Toyota Prius, more or less. We're investigating a possible spectrograph mode. Maybe India is interested in contributing this. And this would be launched by an Indian rocket. That's the baseline at the moment. It goes into a low Earth orbit, 800 kilometers. So that's about 300 kilometers higher than Hubble. And yeah, it's baselined for a five-year mission where it does surveys, combination of surveys, sort of legacy, sort of pointed science, geo time, guest observer time.
Are there consumables that limit the mission lifetime, or is it just budget?
it's just budget. You could extend it, but as I learned, if you want to guarantee a lifetime of a certain time, the cost goes up exponentially. It gets very expensive. So we will design it for 5 years, and we hope it's like IUE and lasts 17 years. But it could be like Kepler, which was designed for 3 years and lasted 3 years, and now it's continuing in a sort of Kepler 2 mode.
Why does it go exponentially?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Why does it grow exponentially, the cost?
Because the technology readiness level, it has to be guaranteed to last certain length of time, for instance, and it becomes more expensive.
So this kind of orbit
yes.
decays too, or like precesses, right? So does that limit the lifetime?
Well, we do have the ability to adjust. I mean, there's power from solar panels, basically, so we're able to adjust the orbit. But one of the things we have to do now, as it turns out, is every new telescope, it's recommended, and CSA adheres to this international recommendation that you have to have a plan for deorbiting the telescope. And so that adds, you have to have some deorbiting mechanism on board. So we have to add that, which we didn't have in our 2012 study. So here's a movie showing Castor in operation based on the earlier design, 2012. These are four solar panels. They deploy to 45 degrees. You'll see the sun back here. That's providing power. That was a cover that protects the primary mirror, which is totally, look over here, this is better. So here, now you're looking down the barrel of the telescope. So that's that silicon carbide mirror. There's Hubble in the background, so it shows the compact design. It has a folded light path, so it's, again, quite compact. And this is the earlier design, which is a slightly different arrangement, but it's comparing the field of view difference between the two telescopes. So that was a Hubble ACS field of view. Castor observes in the ultraviolet, including in the optical. So if you take a look at Galex, which was the previous best imaging mission in the UV, this is what you would see compared with Castor. So it's in this sun-synchronous orbit. It's a polar terminator orbit. It does, as you can see, does this. So as the Earth swings around in its orbit, it points away and points in the direction of the outer solar system and can sort of go up and down from the ecliptic plane and survey wide areas. And here's just a fun thing. People are interested in Planet 9 or other such things, things in the remote outer solar system. You can actually detect these things because something at the Kuiper Belt is moving at about 1 arc second per hour, but they're very faint. And so to find such things, you need something that is very sensitive. It goes deep quickly. And so you can get very deep in a short exposure, and this is what Castor is optimized.
So the light reflected from the sun on Planet 9, you can see?
Yeah. Reflected light.
Wow.
And you have to go to space with a photometry? Or?
Yeah.
You can do it from the ground. So some you can do some of this stuff from the ground. People are using CFHT to do great stuff here. LSST will do this. But the problem is in an individual exposure, you are limited by the depth you can reach, right? Because if you go too long, if you go an hour, then you're basically blurring by the seeing the motion, the reflex motion. And so that sets a fundamental limit. And I'll show in a moment that by being in space, over here, so I'm going to skip this. Yeah, so this one. You have the advantage of getting reaching very low levels very quickly. So look at the upper panel here. This is so this is magnitude, limiting magnitude. This is a 5 sigma point source, limiting magnitude. That's going from 20 to 30 in AB, so confusingly getting fainter. And this is exposure time on a log scale. And so what you can see in the three channels, sort of the green light, the blue light, and the ultraviolet light, these are the exposure, these are the depths we reach in a single exposure with Castor. So how does this compare to LSST? Two of these band passes are in common with the ground-based LSST telescope in Chile. In a single visit, so one exposure with LSST, these are the depths you reach in the U-band. So there, that is the depth, 24th magnitude, one exposure with LSST. But as I told you, LSST is observing again and again and again, and is doing this for 10 years. So you stack the images, and you get to a fainter depth. So after 10 years with LSST, you reach just below 26th magnitude. That's that line. Likewise, in the green G-band, these are the depths. So a single visit, you get down to 25. And at the end of 10 years, you reach to 27.4. But you can see that Castor, if you follow the lines along, you can see that in 2,000 seconds or so, you're reaching the same depth as LSST. So how is that possible? Because you have a 1 meter in space, and you have a 6.7 meter on the ground, exposing repeatedly over a decade. And the answer is because the Castor is diffraction limited, or very nearly, the light is concentrated into a small number of pixels. The sky, so you have good point source sensitivity, you reach, you know, faint levels quickly, and you're also above the atmosphere where the sky is suppressed. So you're very dark. And for faint things, the sky noise, the contribution from the sky is often the limiting factor. So if you look, here's an image. Well, this is an image from the Sloan survey of a dwarf galaxy in Virgo, one of the ones that was on the first slide. Here is what you would see after 5 years with LSST at ground-based resolution. And this is what you would see with Castor in an hour of exposure. So you can see that you have the gain in depth and you have the gain in spatial resolution. And I think this is going to be extraordinarily important for LSST because at its depths here, you would probably agree that it's source confusion is going to be a real problem. And so if you have some space-based imaging where you can unambiguously split these sources into their components, that would be very important. OK. So things that we're considering at the moment, we're planning our surveys. One thing that the cosmologists on the team are considering is, let's imagine Castor can do standalone science, and it can also leverage other surveys to do the best measurements of a number of different physical effects. I mentioned WFIRST has its 2,000 square degree survey area. This is it here in the south. And so if Castor did a very deep survey here, there's a number of interesting things you could do with it, overlapping with this is covered by LSST and WFIRST and Castor potentially. And in the north, you have Euclid, which is a shallower survey, but wider. And so here you would have a shallower survey with Castor, but over a wider area. LSST will not reach this region. OK, I'm not going to go into that. OK, so just a few possible science applications. Like I did earlier, showed some applications with MSE. Here are some instances of what you could do with a mission like this. So dark energy is one of the main motivating factors for LSST, Euclid, WFIRST, et cetera. In all cases, there'll be a measurement made basically looking at the growth of structure through weak lensing measurements. But to make use of the weak lensing measurements, what you would ideally like to have is the best possible distance, which comes from photometric redshifts. And to get the photometric redshift, you need the spectral energy distribution covered as over as wide a range as possible, with measurements having the smallest possible error bar. And so here are some simulations done by our colleagues at Caltech. This is showing what you could do. This is simulated redshift, photo Z, versus spectroscopic. This is simulated, and this is the actual. And so in a perfect case, you'd have a thin line with no outliers. And so here, if you follow this down, you can see that Castor plus LSST plus Euclid, for instance, this would be the ultimate in terms of the smallest sigma in between the measured and the actual photometric redshifts with the smallest number of outliers. And then there's secondary issues like object blending and detection, which will be very crucial for at the very faint end of the distribution for LSST. And ideally, for weak lensing measurements, systematics are always the dominant factor. And so if you're able to make a shape measurement with a different facility at a different wavelength region, that would be very important. Now, one thing that's come up recently, of course, is time domain astrophysics has taken on a whole new importance. In 2010, 2012, when we came up with this concept, we were certainly aware that LSST was coming and that, you know, time domain was going to be important. But now LSST is on the horizon. By some estimates, there will be a million or so transient events per night detected from LSST, depending on how you define that. We're in the era of gravitational wave astronomy and detections looking for associated optical or multi-wavelength detections of these events. Here's a recent famous one, of course. And so the UV region is actually crucial for this because that's the time when the shock breakout is happening. And if you can get constraints on the spectra and on the light curve early on in the UV, and in addition to the long wavelength data, it tells you something about the progenitors, so the what actually exploded. And at the moment, there are a few proposals for small UV satellites to find these things. CASTR's niche here in the post-HST era is not to find these sources, but to get on them reasonably quickly, not like the other ones, which are they localize the event very quickly, but it has the sensitivity and it has the point, the spatial resolution. And potentially, we're investigating a spectroscopic channel. So this would be a unique contribution to this this growth field in the next year.
So is there, the way that you showed the animation before, CASTR looks like it's always looking away from the sun.
Yeah.
How far can you slew the telescope? How rapidly can you slew it?
It's an excellent question. And we've devised that, we chose that orbit and that observing strategy before this time domain thing, we sort of realized how important this was. So we're investigating exactly this. What are the slew times? It's very likely, and let's be honest, CASTR is not going to be a rapid response machine. But for particularly interesting events, if we're able to slew and to follow it up reasonably quickly, then we should be doing. So that's something that the time domain SWIG is going to be investigating. Okay, so again, the issue of dark matter. One of the, this is just one example, which I happen to like. We know that the Milky Way is surrounded by these very faint stellar streams, which are things that have dissolved into the halo of the Milky Way. They've been disrupted. These are interesting. They're hard to find. We know of a number, but even the ones we know of are sort of poorly defined. This is the most spectacular example. This is PAL 5. But they're interesting for a number of reasons, because if you can actually map the streams and you can get the velocities of things along the stream, you can measure the shape of the dark matter, the potential, the galactic potential. There's also a lot of interest these days in looking for basically gaps in the streams that might be impacts of low mass halos, dark matter halos flying through the streams. So this is great, but to find more of such streams, you need to, first off, you need to find such streams, often at large distances. It can be very dilute. And so to do that, you have to make sure that when you find a gap, you find a gap and you know that it's a real gap. So you need good statistics along the streams. And that means you need good image quality to separate the stars from the galaxies. You need wide field coverage and you need depth. So this is something that CASTR can do quite well.
That kink in the stream is a real observed thing?
Yes. Yes. That's the characteristic S shape, right, from something that's being tidally disrupted.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And then you can see there are gaps here, which are modeled down below. And then finally, I mentioned this science case earlier. This is looking for remote things at the edge of the solar system, basically trying to find these things moving. It turns out that just the things that you're most sensitive to, because you go very faint and you find these things, are things that are at the most remote edge of the solar system, or things that are very, very small. And that's sort of unexplored parameter space in either case. And also, if you find such things and you measure them with other telescopes, like WFIRST could do this kind of science as well. But if you can measure these objects and you get the spectral energy distribution all the way down into the UV, then my colleagues who work on this at Hertzberg say this is interesting for looking for the presence of like organic ices and mineralization on the surface of these things.
But, so CASTR will be able to cover all the known possibilities for planet A, because there's some uncertainty, right? They say there's some chance that there's this object.
Yes, there's quite a lot of uncertainty. I think some people believe it's already doesn't exist. They believe that they've shown that it couldn't exist. But it's a contentious thing.
Yeah.
But I would say, in terms of a capability, you know, who knows where we're going to be in 2025 or 2026 when this facility launches. But you want to have the ability to find interesting things in the outer solar system, whether it's a Planet 9, the current one, or a new one, or something. And so that basically points you in this general capability of the wide field and the point source sensitivity.
Paper build objects, right? That would be interesting to characterize in more detail and stuff as well. Is Planet Nine a hook, or is Planet Nine really what you could do? I mean, a multitude of other objects out there.
Yes. Yes, and so this science case is from J.J. Cavalars, who works, does very interesting stuff with Brett Gladman, for instance, at UBC. They work on this, and I think they have views on whether there is a Planet Nine or not, but they're quite interested in the luminosity, the mass function of these objects and the distribution. And that's all I prepared. Thank you.
What's the field of view of the spectroscopic channel? It's using DMD's GASTA, right?
But yes.
What does it cover the whole field of
view? No, it doesn't. So yes, so at the moment, so there's two options for the spectroscopy. One option is, one option is you take this fine steering mirror, and you can put that on a turret. You flip it, and then you have a curved grating, and then you produce low resolution slitless spectroscopy over the free fields. So that would be a resolution on the order of 100, 200, something like that. But many objects simultaneously and subject to overlap and confusion, etc. The other option we're considering is to put in a separate spectroscopic channel, which is one of these DMD devices, as you noted. That would give you a field of view based on the current size of a DMD of something like 120 by 220 arcseconds. So it's a very, it's about half the size of the Hubble ACS. But you get the two-dimensional spectroscopy. It would only operate in the UV, so going from 150 to 300 nanometers, and it would operate at high resolution. So if you're interested in resolutions of up to 1,000, that seems doable.
And that's always available for all of us.
Yes. Yes, it's a parallel instrument in that case. It's seeing, because it's located here, unlike the imaging field, which is you're getting in three channels simultaneously, it's a separate field. And that's something that if you have feelings on the matter, we've asked the science working groups to weigh in on this. Which option do you prefer? And that's something that was going to be decided over the next 6 months or so.